So I hope everyone had a good lunch and feels settled and calm again. How long did your mindfulness last? How did you do? How far at the door did you get?
I wonder if I got as far as the door. No, I was mindful to a certain extent through
Great.
My lunch.
Great.
Especially while I ate, while mm-hmm. I prepared the food, while I ate it.
Mm-hmm. And so there's the sense that we can call ourselves back at any point. We just have to keep remembering that this is what we're choosing to do. So we're going to start with a meditation again, just 6 minutes, very brief. And again, remembering that this is the view, that everything, the disturbing emotions, the view of self and self-absorption, they're called adventitious, which means they're temporary. There's something, things that have to do with causes and conditions coming together and our emotions arising. But there's nothing permanent. The only thing that is truly our being is the seed of Buddha nature within, the element of Buddha nature within. So we're familiarizing ourselves with our mind so that we can just gently, with friendliness, with curiosity and the view of an explorer, find out what our minds are like and what these coverings are. As we discover what the coverings are, they actually dissolve. And that's why they're called veils, because it's a one moment of understanding and a whole veil is gone. So layer after layer, like an onion, disappears as we become more and more familiar with our minds and the patterns and the causes of patterns. So that's the part we're going to look at this afternoon. I want to start again with the posture, because the posture is very interesting. Venerable was talking a lot about the energetics yesterday, and the posture is related to the emotions and the channels and the winds within the body. So they're completely related to our energy systems. The legs and the generally you would be sitting on a cushion, and so you'd have your legs folded in the tailor position, or if you're even more limber, in the lotus position. And that's related to a downward clearing wind and the emotion of jealousy. And then your hands are the winds associated with the earth element and, I'm sorry, with the water element and the emotion of anger. So even by simply holding your hands in this posture, the winds and energy systems in your channels are helping you to dissolve the emotion of anger. The straight spine is associated with the earth element and the emotion of ignorance. Having your chin down and the tongue on the roof of your palate are the winds associated with the fire element and with desire. And having your eyes half open and cast downwards, you can think of it just maybe an arm span away from your body or a little bit in front of your nose, just unfocused, but cast down, is the space element and pride. So as you're attaining your mind by sitting in this posture, you're also working with the inner channel system.
What was the last one? The space element and...
And pride. So your legs are the downward clearing wind and jealousy. Your hands are the winds associated with the water element and anger. Straight spine, the wind associated with the earth element and ignorance. Chin down with the tongue on the roof of your mouth, the winds associated with fire and desire, and eyes downward, the winds associated with space and pride. So all of this very fundamental teaching of just sitting in this posture, when you get to advanced levels of meditation, assists your practice. So you're clearing with the winds by sitting in this posture. With your attention in a relaxed way on your breath, So just before the break, we were talking about training and how our thoughts eventually influence our actions. And we talked about the gross in terms of the actions that are very hurtful that we're fairly aware of in terms of lying or killing or hurtful sexual conduct. And then we talked about speech, the killing, stealing, and sexual, hurtful sexual conduct. And then the speech issues of lying and divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle speech. And then there are three that are related to our minds. So as we start seeing more and more subtle areas of how we're operating in the world, we start to see that we can have what are called harmful thoughts or harmful views. And I love these because they address the contemporary issues of racism and sexism and ageism and all those different things. So the quote from the text is, the training that you'd like to give your mind is away from covetousness. And covetousness is not only in regard to objects, but how you view your own race, your own clan, your body, your qualities, and your wealth, thinking there's no one like me. So it's issues of gender, racism, all the different isms. And so if you're thinking there's no one like me in terms of I'm the best, my race, my gender, whatever, or someone else is, the opposite. Someone else's race is the best, someone else's gender is the best, and wealth, et cetera, et cetera. So that belief system attached to others' prosperity or attached to wealth in the form of somebody's business or somebody's wealth that comes from the earth, a big farm or something like that. So then we can pretty much understand harmful thoughts of hatred or jealousy and resentment. And then there's a third category called wrong view of cause and result. So not believing that positive actions cause positive results and harmful actions cause harmful results. So if you want to deny the basic facts of life, then that's considered a mistaken view. And if you, from the Buddhist perspective, if you start to misunderstand the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and start slandering them, that's a harmful view because it doesn't help you get free. So the sense is, in Buddhism, it's not necessarily a religion, but it's a science of the mind. So it's hurtful if you were avoiding how the mind works. And so you can look at it from that perspective. So this is what's called the Wheel of Life. And in the Tibetan tradition, books were printed by woodblocks, and so there were very few printed books. And so they did a lot of teaching by painting. And this is actually on the wall of the entry of every monastery, helping remind everybody that, yes, you know, we're all in this kind of chaotic mess, and we all want to get out of the chaotic mess. And if we keep repeating the same patterns over and over again, we're going to keep getting the same results. So I think even a fairly young person can see, when you look at the things that seem to be difficult in your life, when you look at the times when you get really angry and really upset about something, you can see that it's actually a similar pattern, that it's always about some particular kind of issue. It may be a different cast of characters, but you start to realize that the patterns are the same. You know, whatever your favorite pattern may be, whatever upsets you the most, whatever makes you the angriest, after a while it's, oh my goodness, it's the same pattern. So this is presented from our view of reincarnation, but we can even look at it just in terms of the patterns that seem to be the chains that are holding our mind and holding our life in the kind of chaos that we want to get out of. So in the center, we see a pig, a peacock, and a snake of anger, jealousy, and ignorance. And then around that are the virtuous actions going up on clouds, and the non-virtuous actions going downwards towards the hell realm. So there's a sense of understanding cause and effect from that perspective. And then around the edge is a very interesting pattern called the 12 links of interdependent origination. And this is really key to understanding how our patterns arise and how they're concretized, why we repeat them over and over and over again. Exactly what is the process, the chain reaction that seems to keep us so trapped. So the first on the top right is a blind man. So the first three have to do with the general conditions of things. So the blind man is considered a symbol of ignorance. We can't see what's going on. We just know that we're in the same patterns over and over again. And from the perspective of the highest view, the ignorance and the Buddha nature arise together. It's considered co-emergent. So each time we're born with this incredible seed of Buddha nature, and as we carry over patterns, we have also ignorance coming at the same time. So there's the blind man traveling, just not knowing where he's going. Then we have the potter. And a potter, I love thinking about these images because they're just so practical. When you're doing pottery, whatever movement you make with your hands shapes the pot. So you're pushing in on the clay and it condenses, and then you change your hands a little differently and it starts to raise up. And so that's the teaching, that whatever you do affects your reality. Every change you make affects the reality in some form or another, just like a potter with the wet clay. And then the third one is consciousness, which is portrayed as a monkey jumping from branch to branch. So that's pretty clear too. That's when we feel like our minds are just out of control, you know, going from one thing to the next, without any control, without any taming, without any stability. So that's the general condition. And then it shows exactly what are the causes of that continuing to arise? What produces? What is the cause? What is the step-by-step of that pattern? So the first one in the step-by-step part are six people in a boat. So the six people in a boat have to do with, it's called name and form, it has to do with how we conceive of a self as an independent being. And it's like what we call the heaps or the aggregates, and then giving that a name. So if we think about who we are, if I were to say, who are you? And you were to start thinking, who am I? First, you would probably say your name. You know, that's the most obvious thing. And then I might say, well, no, who are you? Who are you really? And so you might think, well, I'm my body. I'm a certain age. I'm, you know, this is what my body looks like. I'm in this kind of condition. I have no hair. I'm fat. You know, you think about your body and identify with that. And then if you went a little deeper, you might say, well, I'm my feelings. You know, I'm a person that has great passions, and, you know, I feel things deeply. And if I were to think about who I am, I would say, well, I'm this feeling or that feeling. And then if we went even deeper, you might say, well, it's not just my feelings. That's not exactly who I am, because the feelings change. But I'm my views. I'm my my sense of what's right and wrong. I'm American. I believe in democracy. This or that, how I discriminate identifying things. I understand these rules, I'm of this culture, etc., etc. And the next skanda is, well, it's more than that, it's I'm my will, I'm what I choose to be, I'm my intention, I'm the person who's moving towards this or that. And then finally, you might say, I'm the collection of all my consciousnesses, everything I experience through my eyes, through my mouth, through my nose. And if I were to ask you who you were, at any given moment, you might identify with any one of those things, right? Almost any way of identifying ourselves would come from those things. I'm my experiences, my sensory experiences, I'm my body, I'm my feelings. But you can't say that they're one thing. You can say it's a collection, like all of these six people in a boat. And what we're trying to learn, what we're trying to experience is that we are this collection of things that are always changing, always moving, always developing. We've given it a name. We assume that that's an I, and we're going to investigate, well, is there really any identifiable, permanent I that's in control there, or is it the six people in a boat that are continually traveling down a river, continually changing? So the first thing that contributes to the general state of ignorance, to our blindness, is assuming that the six people in a boat are an I. Then the next one is a house with windows. So we feel like this I is inside a house that has all these different windows, and we're looking out through our eyes, and so we're seeing the fields, or we're looking out through our nose and we're smelling the incense, you know, or we're eating something. So we have all these different kinds of experiences. Then we have all these senses, and we make contact with an object. So you hear something. And in the pictures, they have a very funny image for that. They have a couple making contact. And then the next one is feeling, the feeling due to contact. They have a monkey with an arrow that went in its eye. So when you have that contact, then you have a feeling about it. Is it good or bad? So every time there is a contact, like we might think the bell is good. I like that. If we were to hear, we might think, oh, I don't like that. Every kind of contact has a subtle judgment of like or dislike. And from that, we have some sort of craving or attachment or some sort of resistance. So the next picture is a feast, where that's the sign of the craving. You hear the bell, you like music, then you want music all the time. So you want this feast of everything you like, and you want to be far away from everything you don't like. And then you want to go get it. Then you actually move off your cushion to go get that bar of chocolate. You're thinking about it, you have a little view of attachment, you think about it a lot, the exact kind you want, and then you leave your meditation and you go get it. So then there's the grasping. So this whole cycle, it gets really interesting, and it applies to any addiction, and we know we live in an addicted culture. It applies to any addiction whatsoever. There's a belief in a self, there's the coming together into form of all of these different aggregates. We're looking out through all the sense windows, and because we believe in a self, then we want good things for that self, and we want to push away the bad things. And then we start to associate all kinds of things as being good for us. And then we act to get them. And as soon as we act to get them, then it plants seeds of karma. And then that propels us around the wheel over and over again. So that part of the cycle then moves to birth and death over and over again. The conditioned existence, being in a situation where you're continually creating more karma and more karma and more karma, either virtuous karma or non-virtuous karma, and then old age, birth and death again. But the part that gets really, really interesting is that cycle that leads to addiction. or leads to behavior or leads to anything that seems like something you want to change. So here you have a cycle, and you can start to see, if you're mindful, you can identify the steps of this cycle as it starts to take place. So in this human body, there is a kind of anxious anxiety. So when we look at what is the edginess, what is that first seed, we can identify a kind of feeling that makes us slightly uncomfortable. And people describe it as edginess or slight irritation or slight anxiety. So there's this underlayer of not being quite comfortable. And from that underlayer of not being quite comfortable, we reach out for an idea of something that will bring us comfort. From that, we move into really wanting it, then wanting it so badly that we go and get it. Once we go and get it, we start a pattern. Remember, Venerable was talking yesterday about creating a chemical chain in your brain. Every time you move through that whole cycle and complete it, you create a chemical change in your brain. And so then you create a track. So then you can see, if we were looking from a contemporary perspective at karma, it's creating that chemical chain in your brain. What's really interesting is it's not as though we have to immediately solve the whole addiction. We just need to break the cycle of the pattern. As soon as you break the cycle of the pattern anywhere, then that whole pattern is changed. So if you wait 1 minute longer before you get up, or if you decide, instead of creating the usual pattern of, we'll keep using chocolate, it's so convenient, of going for your afternoon chocolate bar and decide I'm going to go circumambulate the stupa again instead. Any change is a change, and any change breaks the pattern. So with each of your behaviors, as you get more and more mindful, you can see that you're creating spaciousness in your life to make choices. So you can make a choice to say, I'm not going to jump into this pattern. I'm not going to dive in. I'm going to wait 5 more minutes, or I'm going to do something else, or I'm just going to go stand outside and look at the sun. Any change at all changes everything.
Are you saying that the addiction for another cup of coffee, if you delay that, it will help with my addiction for chocolate?
I'm talking about a chain. And so for each person, it might be different things. For me, it happens to be chocolate. And so if
you're talking about one addiction.
One addiction at a time. One addiction at a time is plenty. That's enough for anybody to deal with.
Yes.
Yeah. But most of the time, we go through this whole chain within seconds. With it in a blink of an eye. So we're in the kitchen before we've realized it, before we've even sat with the anxiety. And so as we slow down, as we become more and more mindful, then we start to see the thought of, I want this, as it arises, as opposed to as we're eating it. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And if we can apply it to simple things, like chocolate, then we can apply it to the more difficult things. So if you think of somebody in your life that you have a problem with, no matter what they do, it's irritating to you. Get somebody in my mind like that. So, you know, it could be somebody at work, somebody in your family, somebody anywhere. And you see that before you know it, you're either speaking in a very irritated, reactive way back to them, or you're on the phone with your friends talking about them. But there's an immediate kind of reaction. If you can look at it at the beginning and see, first there's an anxiety or an edginess, and that's triggered. And it's not necessarily the person at all, because the person at all is perfect Buddha nature. It's your particular pattern that's triggered. And it's triggered by some sort of a feeling that that you're trying to reject. So the grasping or running away is the same action, just opposites. So you can identify sooner and sooner what's going on in your particular chain reaction, and you can eventually stop it before you speak in an irritated way to that person. Yeah.
So if you're feeling that edginess, mm-hmm. anxiety, and that's to avoid a feeling that you don't want to really acknowledge, you can stop yourself there and maybe look at the feeling. Would that help to break the pattern?
Yes. It's even the anxiety or the edginess is even underneath the feeling. But you're correct. Anytime you identify any one of these stages, you're stopping yourself sooner before you've completed the action. And so knowing the stages, knowing it's not so simple as you know, reaching over and grabbing it and eating it, knowing that in the blink of an eye there's an impulse, first of a slight discomfort, then of seeing it, then of wanting it, then of grasping it. And the same thing with anger arise, there's an uncomfortable quality. There's the feeling of anger arising. And you know, it's funny because first it's generally an irritation and then an anger. So you allow it to build into the anger. You actually tell yourself a story of, this person is deliberately saying that to hurt my feelings. That's actually going on in your mind. So you're creating the feast, and then you're grasping the anger and acting out on the anger. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I think so. Catching it.
Catching it, exactly.
At that uncomfortable place.
That's what we're...
Would be like, you know, before the snake bites somebody.
Exactly.
Trying to catch it at the head and go, oh, I'm feeling that little shaking or whatever.
Exactly.
You identify that as being with
yes.
whatever
yes.
goes on.
Yes.
And then if you could clearly see that anxiety for what it is,
mm-hmm.
You know, I'm wondering if you could uncover the true root of it.
Well, what's really interesting is from this perspective, it's the edginess is building into a feeling. From the perspective of your Buddha nature, it's your Buddha nature saying, you know, actually, I don't want to be in samsara. Something's not quite right. I want to wake up. So it's actually your Buddha nature calling out to you, saying, no, in fact, something is not quite right. Let's wake up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then,
so nothing actually to reject, but something to notice. So you're sitting down in meditation. It's early in the morning. You could smell the coffee. What happens in between the sitting down and smelling the coffee? You know, and start to notice, you know, that there's this little, slight little angst. What if I sit with that? You know, what if I see it for what it is? All it is this little slight edginess. It doesn't mean I have to jump up, run, get the coffee. See how it works with any kind of addiction? And it's very obvious in addiction because we're over and over and creating fairly harmful to ourselves behavior. But in terms of any other chain reaction of our emotions, it's exactly the same thing.
And are we trying to solve that feeling of anxiety by then deepening our meditation or are we just trying to ignore it? Or what's our relationship to that little edginess, to that little anxiety?
I think we want to make friends with it.
Okay.
This is something about the human condition. This is what we're trying to run away from, escape from. And is it what is it? And to really look at it and rest with it and befriend it.
We're not trying to kill it.
No, we're not trying to kill it.
Okay.
But we're not trying to run away from ourselves or our minds or any part of ourselves. And in order to do that, we have to see it. In order to see it, we have to understand what the exact chain reaction is. So it's easy to think about any pattern whatsoever in your life, any particular kind of difficulty, and see, oh, it's not one giant obstacle, one giant block, one giant difficulty. It's something that arises in specific stages, and you can interrupt it at any stage. And the sooner you interrupt it, the better. Yeah.
So is it sort of like, let's say you have an automatic response to something.
Mm-hmm.
So you put your hand on something hot and you automatically take it off without. So with this, with other things that happen, you have an automatic response. You haven't meditated, so that's how you do it. You have like a little time to process it so that you can decide what it is. It doesn't become an automatic response.
In our lives, it seems automatic. It feels to us like it's automatic. Like every time I say this person, they say something nasty to me, and so I get my feelings hurt, right?
So does it slow down that process so you can see it?
Slow down that process so you can see it.
And not react the exact same way every single time.
And not react the exact same way every time. Because every reaction is creating karma. And every time you react the same way, you make it easier to react that way the next time and the next time and the next time. So you're building a pattern that is being reinforced every time you react the same way. Can you relate to that? Are there things that you're touchy about that make sense to you?
Yeah, well, so, well, I've worked with anger most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And there are still times when I may regret it after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Because the anger came up and was up there, mm-hmm. like before,
mm-hmm.
before I could catch it, you know, and
mm-hmm.
do it a different way or not mm-hmm. react that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't happen as often,
because
mm-hmm. I've worked with it a long time, but it's that the speed of it happening.
Yes.
Yes.
So it's true, you may not be able to quickly change your behavior, but you'll start to see the behavior, and then you'll start to see space, and then you'll be able to interrupt the patterns. The more you can see the pattern, the more space there is in the pattern, and the more you can make different choices. But it's dependent on being aware of what's going on, the mindfulness. So going back to how we've been looking at the day, you know, we've been just doing the walking meditation. Now, if you apply that same mindfulness to when you're in an argument with someone, you know, how do you maintain mindfulness when you're in an argument to see what is it that's causing all of the emotion to arise in you? And do you have to react the same way every single time? Can you do something different this time? Then it gets really, really interesting, because one of the things that we grasp onto, if we move beyond addictive things, which are very easy to relate to and very easy for... So probably, is there anybody who's not addicted to anything? I don't know. But what we don't know so much is how we're attached to our views about things. So again, just like when we were talking about the different kinds of body speech and then thoughts, there are body things that are on a gross level. Speech things, like patterns of speaking harshly, that arise with these different links. But there are also views. We're attached to our views about things. Like, we think that some things are definitely right and some things are definitely wrong. And we're sure we're correct about it, aren't we? Yeah. Mm-hmm. We know, you know. I know this is right. I know this one will make a better president. No, this one will make a better president. So if we look at how attached we are to our views, and that this has to do with, if you follow it back, some sort of belief in self, and some desire to protect that self, and some sense that the views are yourself, and grasping onto those views and holding onto the views, and that becomes a real basis of enmity. So you can stop yourself in the pattern saying, well, am I continuing like this in a stubbornness because I believe I should be right, because I believe my view should be right? Is there anything intrinsically correct about my view about this? Then it allows us not to grasp so hard onto that view. And that's a much more difficult area to work with, because we have it, again, linked with our belief in self, and it's more subtle. Can think of any area of your life where you think you know the correct way to do it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, with the mindfulness, we see that there are choices in any situation. And we can choose to do something different. We can choose to stop ourselves at a sooner part in the chain reaction, and we can choose to let go totally. So the object as meditators becomes keeping that spacious mind that has choices, not being right or wrong. And it's another reason to get so familiar with your mind and with your breath, because you can always just return to your breath and look at your state of mind. And sometimes it can even seem like your mind is turned into concrete because you're holding on to a view so tightly, you know, or an addiction so tightly.
And you sometimes not even know where it comes from.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It just past, could be past, could be found, could be anything.
Yes. Yeah. And many things do go back to early childhood, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Could you please repeat what the sentence that you said, the object of meditator is what?
One of the reasons why it's wonderful to work with your breath as an object of meditation, the object of concentration, because in any situation, your breath is present. And you can just quickly connect to breathing and this practice of returning to your breath, just focusing on breathing and noticing the state of your mind. And then you can notice, is the state of my mind racing? Is it like concrete that it's so fixated? When you're enraged, it feels like your mind is totally fixated, so it's like a block of concrete. Or is it open and spacious? When we were talking this morning about Buddha mind, Buddha nature, and we were giving the examples of the Buddha's mind being an open, spacious quality that has the nature of compassion, we know that we're heading towards trouble if we're letting our minds get more and more solid and racing and fixated. And we know we're heading towards our Buddha nature if we're letting our minds relax and get more and more open and spacious. So it doesn't become any more about right or wrong, I want this or I don't want this, I want to run away from it or push it away or fight it. It becomes, how am I holding my mind? See how interesting that becomes?
So it becomes about your condition.
Yes.
Observing your condition.
Exactly.
Rather than the outer shell.
Yeah. Yeah.
You said open, spacious, compassion, and the other one was solid, fixed, and...
You can put your own adjectives. When I observe my mind, it feels like concrete. So I think of it as solid, fixated, obsessed, that kind of thing. So one thing you can do is compare, going back to your breath, see is your mind relaxed? Are you observing thoughts and letting them go? Or are you holding on to something, an idea of you? Is it something that's so strong that it's compelling you to do an action that you don't want to do? So if we can look at it from that perspective, is it compelling you to do something that you don't actually want to do? Is it compelling you to do something that in the long run is going to bring you suffering or someone else suffering? So if our goal is to not harm ourselves and not harm others, our state of mind is always a cue. And if we can see that there is a really clear pattern with stages, something happens, you tell yourself a story about it, you get angrier and angrier and angrier until you take action. So you can see that you're actually propelling yourself into an act that would be harmful. Can you stop it at that point? Can you stop it just when you first become irritated? Can you stop it early and earlier when you just have just a slight angst and say, oh, this is just me today in this moment. This is just what is. It never has to extrapolate, become inflamed, become something. That's why they use the word chains. You know, you're not chained to your patterns. You can break your patterns at any time. We call it breaking the fetters. Which means you have a choice. You don't have to repeat the patterns over and over. And the key is mindfulness. The key is understanding how your mind works. So you see, even just observing yourself in a full-blown pattern, allows you to see what you're doing, as opposed to be doing it without any awareness. You know, you're all of a sudden yelling at some dear Buddha without knowing how you got there. So we're trying to know how we are getting into these situations so we can get ourselves out. And as we get ourselves out, every single thing we learn on the path that gets us out of these chained habitual patterns becomes how we help others. Oh, I learned this. This is why I do this over and over again. It's because I believe my race is the best. I get in a hurtful situation because of that. It's because I believe my political system is the best. I get in a difficult situation over that. Because I feel like I need wealth, so I get in a difficult position after that.
So because we are reactive, or because we project view on the screen, that's what happens? Is the idea not to react?
Yes.
To just observe?
Well, to see that there are identifiable stages in the reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And you can stop it at any point. And as you become more and more aware, you can stop it sooner and sooner. The screen is really the belief in a solid self,
mm-hmm.
and a belief in your reality and an external reality as being what it appears to be in an unthoughtful, unconsidered way. So if we really think about it, like for instance, if we look at the mountain, It's the same as ourself, so it's a good way to see how we make collections of things and then believe in it.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at the mountain, we say that's Mount 8, right? We all accept that that's Mount 8. But then when we look at Mount 8, well, there are lots of rocks there, there are trees there, there's dirt there.
Mm-hmm.
There's no actual Mount 8. There's a collection of stuff that we call Mount 8. Yes, and here we are, a river of experiences, of many different kinds of experiences that we call an I and we give a name to.
Mm-hmm.
And we behave as though that this is a separate, totally separate being. We believe we're permanent. Even though we know we're going to die, it's like me and the chocolate, we believe we're permanent. And we believe that we're in control of things. You know, that we can control everything. So there are these qualities that we're independently existing. If we were to investigate it, I don't know what a physicist would see, but he might see, or she might see, densities of electrons, you know, not individually, totally separate beings. So we want to have the understanding of being interrelated, interdependent, interconnected. But it's easier to see it as Mount A than it is to see that this this self that we're so accustomed to seeing as just one self, totally separate from everybody else, is not who we appear to be. We are not what we appear to be.
See, I've been paid in the course of time.
Yes, because as soon as you believe you're separate and you believe someone else is other, then there's a reason to protect the self and not protect as much the other.
Mm-hmm.
Or dislike the other. So you would value yourself just a little more.
Yeah.
I was really interested when Josie just had her baby, because it's a really interesting moment, because before you give birth, it's still yourself. And when the baby comes out of your body, there isn't that separation yet. And so there's an instinctual, if the baby is crying, that's me crying. And if we could truly understand our interconnectedness and interrelatedness, anybody crying would be me crying. And that's why we want to look at why we believe that we're a separate self. That's why it's the basis of really understanding compassion. So then we develop the self, and then we reinforce it with all of these habitual patterns that we repeat over and over again, and we can unwind them by just traveling back along the same lines, along the lines that they came up. And that's where the shamatha meditation gets really interesting, because shamatha then slides right into what's called vipassana meditation. So if we're able to concentrate, and if we're able to really focus and place our mind where we wish to place it, then we can start looking. And we can start seeing, well, is there a self in there? If I investigate my feelings, is there actually an I there? Is there actually an I in the body? Is there actually an I in the senses? If our mind is continually jumping around, it will still flit from the body, the emotions, the senses, the views, the sense consciousness. That's what we're doing all of the time. If we can start seeing in a precise kind of way, we can start examining, is there anything that's separate, that's findable? Is that clear? Do you see what the connection is with understanding compassion and understanding that through?
No. Yes.
Finding the self. So as the patterns decrease, then you start addressing the more subtle layers, until as we become Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, then we see there is this radiant awareness that is only compassion. So they say that the first stage of a Bodhisattva is a actual totally sincere, perfect motivation to benefit others, to the point where you do not see any difference or separation between yourself and others. So now we have the aspiration to be bodhisattvas. We have some kindness in which we help others, some compassion in which we help others, but we still separate, this is me doing this for them. At the stage of a bodhisattva, that separation is for the first time absolutely gone, and that there's no distinction.
Now, earlier I made a note to ask you later.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that I heard you say that I'm sorry, I can't find my note. I just, if I remember this.
Okay. Well, you might remember it. The wonderful thing is we're not trapped in any pattern at all. There is space and there's choice. And you look at just the 6 minutes of meditation that we've done a few times today, that's created a new habit or pattern. And so now when you're breathing, just from one day, you remember, oh yes, I can touch base with that. And you can touch base more and more and extend that 6 minutes. And that gives you a touchstone in any situation. So you could even be tremendously angry with someone and just take one breath, and that changes the pattern. The next time it's two breaths, the next time it's stopping yourself before you get really angry, and the next time it's noticing the anger starting to arise. Space and choice. The Dalai Lama calls it internal disarmament. He says very clearly that if we want peace, we have to disarm ourselves first.
So we have to work through ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Because our patterns are the human condition. It's no different than collective groups of people in a city fighting with each other, than people in states fighting with each other, than countries fighting with each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's all arising from the same pattern. And it really is changing. So if you think of the peace marches in the 70s, where everybody wanted peace, but they were yelling at the other side, didn't actually produce peace. And now we're much more aware of that. So I think the more recent peace marches have been much more conscious of spreading kindness and relating to the policemen who are helping keep everybody safe, and relating to the politicians, as opposed to creating more and more aggression. So this wheel of life and this awareness of our own patterns is an everyday, every moment, mindfulness of what is happening. So we have the mindfulness on the object, mindfulness on the emotions, mindfulness of the body, are you sitting, standing, or walking, and mindfulness of mind. What is going on in my mind? What patterns am I creating? So just by saying an offering before and after food, you're creating a pattern of gratitude and of abundance. And it's a totally different pattern than an addictive pattern. So it's great news. There's hope. We too can have a peaceful, content, compassionate mind.